with my most cherished dream to have my sister near. And for that, I had Mr. Church to thank. To please his wife, he'd retired from public service in London and moved their entire family to New York, where they planned to stay. "Church has changed," my sister confided later, while our combined family of hooligans ran through the wide halls of her nearly empty house, and her new lady's maid, a slave named Sarah, unpacked her trunks. "For the better." "Truly?" Angelica sighed with apparent contentment as we toured her new home. "By some miracle, we've found our way back to love. Isn't marriage funny that way?" Then she laughed. "Not that you know anything but the delight of marriage, of course. Not you and Hamilton, but for the rest of us." It made me queasy to realize that I knew of all my sister's marital troubles, and yet she knew nothing of mine. It hadn't been safe to confide it in a letter, but to keep it from her now felt almost like a betrayal of the bond we shared. On the other hand, to tell her would seem a betrayal of the man I loved. And what did it matter, now that it was all in the past? "A fountain," Angelica cried as we walked out into her new garden. "You and Hamilton know me so well. You couldn't have chosen a better house for me, Betts. Forgive me, Eliza," she said with a smile, observing me. I'd written her long ago about my decision to go by the new nickname, but we'd been so long separated that this was the first time she'd seen me in person since I'd made the change. "Old habits." "You may call me whatever you like as long as you are here," I said. "I am here, and now that we are such close neighbors, I foresee you and I spending much time here together, presuming..." When she trailed off, I prompted, "Presuming..." She looked to the sky. "Presuming, of course, that the Jacobins don't burn it all down." A wreath of smoky haze had enveloped the city for months, the remainder of a series of devastating fires that had been set in protest of the election of John Adams to the presidency. Not even the fact that Jefferson, having received the second most number of votes in the election, was now vice president, seemed to stem the tide of discontent. The culprit had never been caught, but the stench of the ashes remained. And like everyone else, Angelica had a definite opinion about who was to blame. "How could you let Hamilton quit the government when the spirit of Jacobinism threatens the political and moral world with a complete overthrow? He's needed there more than ever." It had been the loss of our baby that convinced him to leave government, which she knew from my letters. Still, I felt the need to say, "He said the change was necessary and agreeable." Angelica sighed. "The country has lost one of her best friends, and you, my dear Eliza, are the only person to whom this change can be either necessary or agreeable. Yes, I am decidedly inclined to believe that it was your influence." So what if it was? Angelica had charmed all of Europe and understood more about politics and philosophy than I did. But she didn't understand all that had happened here, in our marriage and our country. I loved my sister, but I was no longer the young girl who deferred to her every opinion, especially since she and Church still kept slaves, whilst my husband was finally free to devote more time to abolishing slavery. No one's done more for this government than Alexander Hamilton, and he's done enough. She blinked, then finally nodded. "Of course." Wanting to smooth things over, I smiled. "Besides, as we now both benefit from his increased attention, you'll soon see it's altogether agreeable." She laughed. "That so good a wife, so tender a mother, should be so bad a patriot is wonderful." So bad a patriot. Her tone was teasing, but she'd somehow hit upon a guilty nerve. Was I so selfish for wanting my husband to belong more to me than to an ungrateful public? Was it wrong to enjoy the fruits of all our labor, the domestic pleasures of picnics with our children, and long walks together on kissing bridges, and dinner at our own table without expecting a horde of guests. Perhaps sensing my inner turmoil, my sister sat at the edge of her fountain to say, "I suppose it's for the better. Now that Papa is back in the Senate, he wouldn't like to be outshone by his son-in-law." We both smiled, knowing how much pleasure it gave Papa to have been re-elected nearly unanimously. He'd bided his time, and Burr, sensing the change of political fortune on the wind, had resigned his seat rather than lose it. My family counted that a good thing, but I remembered what Burr had said at Vauxhall Gardens. "Retirement is very fashionable these days amongst men who wish to be president," Angelica went on. "Besides, it's better that you have Hamilton to look over you in your condition." I half wished to remind her that our own mother had children well into her 40s, and I was only 39. But my sister had centered directly on another of my most keen anxieties, as was her way. I feared miscarrying another child, and I said so. "This time you'll have me here with you, my dearest," she promised. "I shall watch over you with such overbearing insistence, you'll think I've turned into Mama." Like a sentinel who'd forgotten his duty, I startled awake. Round with a child that often awakened me in the night by kicking in eagerness to be out into the world, I was now prone to nap in the heat of the day, this time in a rocking chair on my porch while shucking peas, lulled to sleep by the sound of Anna practicing at the piano, while Fanny sketched with charcoal beside me. But now everything was silent, but for the buzzing of a few lazy bees, and Fanny was nowhere to be seen. Only my husband, who stood staring not 3 feet away, his brow furrowed, his hands deep in his pockets. Disoriented, I squinted against the blazing sun, then pushed myself up. But Alexander stopped me. "No, my darling, don't get up. I didn't mean to wake you." Still, a mother can never be comforted by quiet. Noisy little ones were much less likely to be up to mischief. But the children...
"They're at your sister's house for the night. I had Philip take them."
The flatness of his voice told me something was amiss. My husband could, in a courtroom, exhibit 100 different expressions from anger to sympathy to joy. His blank, haggard expression made me go hollow inside, even before he said, "There is something I must tell you, my angel." My mouth went instantly dry, for I remembered the last time he said, "There is something I must tell you, my angel," and I was sure that he remembered it too.
"I am usually a man who knows the right thing to do, but today," he sighed, "I am at a loss. I thought to shield you from this, but I don't wish for you to be taken unawares, especially not in your condition."
"Tell me." I stiffened, wondering, traitorously, if he was going to confess another mistress. I hated myself for that.
"You know of the newspaper man, James Callender?"
I nodded, because that vile Jacobin scandal-monger had been the source of too many libels to count.
"He's published a pamphlet dredging up the old accusations of my supposed corruption at the Treasury."
I blew out a cautious breath. "A thing for which you've been exonerated at least 3 times over by my count."
"He is also exposing my connection to Mrs. Reynolds."
Connection. The euphemism was a blow. And just like that, the fragile foundation I'd rebuilt myself upon began to fracture. I could almost hear the crack. I'd thought this all done and buried. Now someone had resurrected it. Resurrected her. Maria. I'd always worried that the secret might come out, that Aaron Burr might blurt it drunkenly at a dinner party, that the harlot herself might whisper it on the pillow of whatever man she was bedding now. But I'd imagined only whispers, Never that anyone would be depraved enough to print it. What does the newspaper man know? What could he know, after all?
Everything, Alexander replied quietly. Callender has copies of letters exchanged between us.
Letters? I'd somehow never understood that my husband had done more than go to bed with this woman. He wrote to her. Were they love letters? Letters like the ones he'd written to me when we were courting? I didn't ask. Truthfully, in that moment, I didn't want to know the answer. What I wanted, most of all, in the face of this humiliation, was to hold on to calm dignity.
She sold her correspondence,
I guessed.
Alexander shook his head. No. These are the letters I provided to James Monroe. He's leaked them.
Monroe? My first thought was that I must have misheard. Of all the friends with whom we'd parted for political reasons, Monroe was the most upright and honorable. He was a gentleman. I could scarcely credit that he would trade in such filth. My second thought was that, years ago, he'd promised to protect my honor. And my third was that it wasn't even possible, because Monroe had been serving as our minister to France. He isn't even in the country.
The president revoked his credentials and recalled him. He's just returned to our shores, and no doubt straightaway conspired with Jefferson's loathsome faction. He's given the newspapers every scrap of evidence he promised to keep confidential.
I could make no sense of this. But Monroe gave me his word of honor to keep quiet about this affair. At this, my husband glanced at me, then again, plainly startled.
You discussed it with him.
Under my husband's stunned scrutiny, I reminded him exactly how such conversation came about. Yes, on the night the investigators came to the house.
Alexander's jaw clenched. Though he knew what it had cost me that night, bleeding with near-fatal humiliation. Well, I regret to report that you prevailed upon his friendship in vain.
I still didn't want to believe this of Monroe. I rebelled against believing it. I was no longer naive about the sins men were capable of, even men I'd loved. But there seemed some part of the story untold. I'd taken solace in the idea that there ought to be no reason for anyone to attack us if only Hamilton stayed out of the public eye, if he stayed out of politics. Why now? I asked. Monroe had kept the secret 4 years. With you in retirement, what possible advantage?
I don't know, my husband said, hanging his head, the weight of his guilt forcing the slump of his shoulders. Revenge, maybe. It was upon my advice that the president recalled Monroe from France.
At hearing this, I was overcome with the urge to reach for the bowl of shucked peas and throw it. Into the yard, at the house, maybe even at my husband. I didn't know which. I'd never guessed, not even once, that the wreck of Monroe's diplomatic career was my husband's doing. And as I struggled to calm myself, Alexander took my hand.
I promise you, my darling, I wasn't the only one urging the president to revoke Monroe's credentials. Our foreign policy must be spoken in one voice. Monroe in France and Jay in England were at cross purposes overseas. I gave the president my best advice.
Reeling, I yanked my hand away. He met my eyes beseechingly.
Eliza, I didn't think it right to risk the good of the country, all for fear of a secret any man held over me. I didn't want to think that Monroe, who'd been both a friend to me and a fellow soldier, would prove to be both a man mistaken in his political beliefs and also without honor as a gentleman.
As I listened, his voice softened.
Would you have me done differently?
I paused to think about it, but I was not, in the end, so bad a patriot. No. You did precisely as you should have. There was a moment of grace between us that I could admit this. I think he felt it, too. What will we do now? Bringing my fingertips to his lips, he said, I fear I must confess my wrongdoing. And as panic tightened my throat, he explained why. Callender claimed that my husband invented an imaginary infidelity to cover up his real crime of having enriched himself at the taxpayer's expense. As if we'd been at all enriched. How often had I accepted gifts from my parents to put food on our table? How many years had I borrowed and bartered and scrimped to make ends meet? My husband had left the service of our country poorer than when he entered it, deeply indebted to my brother-in-law and without any real property of his own. But as I wrestled with my anger at the injustice of this accusation, I also realized the perversity of the situation. You can't defend yourself against charges of corruption without confessing the affair. Worse, he couldn't defend himself without convincing the public of the affair.
I've no choice but to expose everything.
But I saw a way out of the corner he'd been backed into. If Monroe will explain to the public that he investigated the matter long ago and believed your innocence, surely that will put an end to it.
He won't,
Alexander replied. He might, if you asked him.
Not after our quarrel this morning.
I startled. You've seen Monroe. There, in the stifling heat, Alexander bit out a laugh.
By happenstance, he's here in New York visiting his wife's relatives. I deduced his part in this conspiracy and confronted him.
And? I asked. Alexander's gaze darkened, as if in stormy remembrance.
And some words were said that ought never be said amongst gentlemen. If it hadn't been for church breaking us apart, we'd have come to blows then and there.
My baby kicked inside me, as if to express its own dismay at this revelation. Church had been there. My brother-in-law knew everything then. Maybe Angelica did too. And soon, so would the whole country know about my husband's infidelity. Though I had little idea of the extent of it, I realized that my marriage was to be sported with, that I was soon to be a laughingstock, my children subject to mockery, that our enemies were going to destroy all the happiness we'd fought so hard to find, the happiness that we'd earned, unless I did something about it. It wasn't a far walk to Monroe's lodgings on Wall Street, where I handed a Negro slave my calling card and was shown into a gilded parlor to wait. The hour was late for a visit, but none of the usual rules of propriety seemed to matter to anyone else, so why should they matter to me? I hadn't told my husband of my intention for fear he might attempt to prevent me, and he wasn't entitled to. I'd taken no part in the decisions that brought us to this place, but I wanted some choice in what happened now. I didn't ask permission, I just went. And waited. It had been 4 years since I'd last seen James Monroe, but when, at length, the Virginian strode into the parlor, he was as tall and strapping as ever. Though he eschewed pantaloons in favor of old-fashioned knee breeches and stockings, he'd acquired a new elegance to his gait in Paris. In truth, I might have been intimidated by the personage he presented if I didn't still remember him as a blushing, stammering boy of a soldier with a dimple on his chin just like mine. Monroe cleared his throat and drawled,
I would delight in your company, Mrs. Hamilton, under other circumstances. However, as your husband has sent you and my wife is with her family, I cannot invite you to stay.
Hamilton didn't send me, I said, unfastening the bow of my bonnet and laying it upon the chair beside me to signal that I had no intention of leaving. Though I've been made aware of your quarrel.
Quarrel? Monroe snorted. Your husband launched into a lengthy diatribe filled with accusations.
I'm not here to accuse you. I looked directly into the gray eyes of the southern gentleman, who had, in a dark time, once been my only confidant.
and felt as vulnerable to him now as I did then.
4 years ago, I didn't doubt your word when you swore you'd spare me humiliation. I don't doubt it now. Tell me that you didn't give the Reynolds letters to the newspaper men, and I will believe you.
Monroe's shoulders rounded.
My faith in him plainly pierced his puffed-up sense of outrage. He seemed relieved that I pledged to trust him, but his encounter with Alexander had left him still in an icy cold fury.
"Of course I didn't give the letters to the newspapers," Monroe finally said. "When I was sent to France, I entrusted my official documents to a friend in Virginia under seal. I've only just returned to the country and had no idea of their publication."
I believed him. Truly I did. "Then the blame must go to your friend in Virginia, who could be none other than Thomas Jefferson." But Monroe set me onto my heels by saying,
"I presume John Beckley published the papers in question."
Beckley was a name I knew only slightly. A one-time indentured servant who had, through the grace of his populist political leanings, risen to be a clerk in the House of Representatives. How should a mere clerk come to have possession of these papers? Monroe could no longer hold my gaze.
"Because I commissioned him to copy them, never suspecting he'd make a set of his own to do mischief with."
A crimson flush swept over Monroe as he admitted to me, however obliquely, that the situation was at least partly his fault. And all at once I felt a cold fury of my own. "Mr. Monroe, for what purpose would you have a clerk copy papers that you swore on your honor to keep confidential?" I should not have said the word honor, not to a Virginian.
"It was your husband who demanded copies."
Then, perhaps in the horror of having shouted at a lady, Monroe went silent. Perfectly silent. While I marveled at the folly of my husband, who had, like the lawyer he was, apparently asked for copies of the most damning evidence against him. Oh, Alexander. When Monroe finally broke his silence, he seethed.
"Did Hamilton think I would stoop to set my own hand to the wretched task of copying his lengthy treasons against you?"
His gray eyes caught mine again with a meaningful stare that recalled the moment, years ago, when he pressed my hand to his heart.
"And if you think me capable, then you've never understood my attachment to you."
Once such words might have touched me, but now my chest heaved with indignation. "Mr. Monroe, how can you claim any manner of attachment when I entrusted to you my fragile happiness, only to find it carelessly disregarded so as to save you a cramp in the wrist and—" I cut myself off, remembering my purpose. It was not to antagonize James Monroe. It was to enlist his aid. I was becoming too much like Alexander, infected by his short temper. I struggled to regain my composure. With a deep, calming breath, I started again. "Mr. Monroe, the scurrilous newspaper men will say what they will, the whispers I shall have to bear. But when you investigated my husband for corruption, you were convinced of his innocence, were you not?" Monroe nodded, though I sensed reluctance.
"Your husband's explanation of how he was extorted removed our suspicions of his being connected with Mr. Reynolds in speculation."
Relieved, I smiled at him. "If you will only say as much, if you will give a sworn statement for the public, then you will relieve my husband of the necessity of a defense, the extreme delicacy of which will be very disagreeable to me." Monroe turned, strode a few paces, then returned, his voice gentler, a little warmer.
"Trust that I regret the publication of these papers, but trust, too, that dragging me into it will draw more public attention to it and make it a matter of even greater consequence. It will not help."
An easy thing for him to say, I thought. "Still, we should like the option. And as you've been the inadvertent cause of this business, it's incumbent upon you as a man of honor and sensibility to come forward in a manner that would shield me. I didn't hesitate to appeal to his honor now. But again, I shouldn't have, because his eyes flew wide.
I am the cause of this business. Oh, no, madam. It was the scoundrel to whom you pledged your troth who exposed you to this. Not me.
Scoundrel. A word that betrayed utter contempt. The sort of word that could start a duel. The word was nearly a slap to my cheek. And perhaps I needed a good slap to bring me to my senses. Are you enjoying having me at your mercy? A damsel in distress? I asked. Do you wish for me to beg? Monroe pinched at the bridge of his nose. Good God. I could never enjoy causing you distress.
But if I'm a casualty of your partisan revenge, it doesn't trouble you.
That's not the way of it. In truth, I have no desire to persecute your husband, though he justly merits it.
Does he? I asked, bristling.
The offense Alexander committed was against me. What right did Monroe have to judge him? He is innocent of the charges that Mr. Jefferson's faction lay at his feet.
Not according to the latest tale told by Mr. Reynolds.
A flash of rage burned through me at the implication that my husband's word should weigh no more than that of a low-bred villain who played the pimp for his own wife. That my brilliant husband stood upon the same footing as this insignificant little fraud. A champion of equality might see it that way. But that wasn't why Monroe put my husband into the same category. It was because Monroe considered himself a member of a club to which a bastard-born foreigner might never truly be admitted, no matter his merits and talent. James Monroe was born on the right side of the blanket, with a speck of dirt in Virginia to call his own, and he thought that made him better. My husband is not capable of corruption. Monroe stared as if he couldn't quite believe a woman would challenge him this way.
I presume you didn't know he was capable of adultery either. I wish the public might behold in Hamilton that immaculate purity to which he pretends. But, my lady, we both know he pretends. And even if I were tempted by your friendship to say otherwise, I have other friends to whom I am obligated.
Other friends? Mr. Jefferson, I presume.
He didn't answer, and he didn't have to. For partisan politics had become so strident and divisive that even someone as honorable as James Monroe refused to do what was right because it would cost him politically. He didn't want to offend Jefferson. He couldn't afford to offend Jefferson. The thought of such craven calculation made me angry enough to spit. And perhaps a little petty, too. Do you know, Mr. Monroe, that I've always dismissed the gossip that you were in Jefferson's thrall? I was foolish enough to defend you when Federalist ladies said it's to Jefferson that you owe the whole of your advancement, and that you and Madison vie for his approval like royal courtiers.
Monroe stiffened. I'm afraid the hour grows late and our interview must come to an end.
I was not finished. I refused to believe that while my husband suffered yellow fever, you sat at a table and toasted to my husband's speedy demise.
I did not join in that toast, Monroe snapped.
My heart sank, because I'd never truly believed the toast took place at all. Now, at his admission, the flame of rage scorched my cheeks, and where I would normally restrain myself, my voice boomed low like a cannon. It seems I have been very mistaken about you, or you have changed very much, because the James Monroe I thought I knew, the hero of Trenton, was not the sort to sit back in cowardice and allow such a toast to be made in his presence. He flinched, but I could draw no satisfaction from it, because I knew that accusing him of cowardice blew to bits whatever remained of our friendship. Though clearly there was nothing to salvage. Monroe was a Virginian before he was an American. Maybe he was even a Jacobin before he was a Virginian. And I believed that, like the rest of Jefferson's detestable faction, if it ever came to a guillotine blade above my neck, Monroe would let it fall. What else could I think now? Which made him an enemy. My husband's enemy, my enemy, an enemy of the country that once called him a hero. And realizing it, I could no longer bear the sight of him or his dimpled chin. Refusing assistance, I wordlessly snatched my bonnet and pushed myself up to go. I was halfway to the door when he said, "Betsy, please, stop." I did not stop. I did not even look back. "I am Mrs. Hamilton. I leave you to your conscience, sir, if you can find it." Chapter 29. The public has long known you as an eminent and able statesman. They will be highly gratified in seeing you exhibited in the novel character of a lover. James Callender, in an open letter to Hamilton. July 1797, New York City. Anger had somehow given me a vim and vigor no pregnant woman in her 9th month ought to feel. "Church," I said with a nod as I came upon him sitting at his breakfast table when I arrived to collect my children. My brother-in-law pinched the bridge of his nose, as if staving off a hangover from a late-night card game. He jolted at the sight of me, and though he was never a man for endearments, he cried with cheer that rang falsely in my ears,
"Eliza, my dear, I hope you're feeling well."
I gave what I'm sure was a brittle smile. "I'm feeling as well as can be expected."
"Good, good,"
Church said, his gaze falling almost involuntarily to where, amidst polished silver trays, a bowl of sugar, and discarded floral teacups, a newspaper lay open.
"You mustn't let the opposition distress you, not in your condition."
I suppose he meant well. After all, men could work themselves up into killing rages, but women must never be distressed. But if he thought our political parties were merely in opposition, trading places like the Tories and the Whigs in England, he was blind. "The men opposed to my husband are nothing but a knot of scoundrels. Their words make not the slightest impression upon me." I snatched up the paper and pressed it into his hand. "And this is fit for nothing but use in the privy." Church barked with laughter as I went in search of my sister, bracing myself against her pity, or some inevitable story about licentious Englishmen or permissive French marriages that she might offer to comfort me. Like her husband, Angelica was not an early riser. She was still in some elegant state of undress, a white gossamer chemise, a dark braid of hair over one shoulder, when I found her in the carefully sculpted English garden, snipping roses so viciously that leaves dropped like rain.
"Were you never going to confide in me about Hamilton's harlot?" she asked.
I'd braced myself against her pity. I had not anticipated wounded feelings. I suppose I should have, not only because Angelica tended to put herself at the center of things, but also because I had wronged her after a fashion. "I didn't dare confide it in a letter," I said, and that was true, for letters could be intercepted. I'd been desperate for my sister's comfort 4 years ago, but by the time she'd returned, I hadn't any desire whatsoever to reopen the wound. And yet, there was another guilty truth. My sister had bared her soul to me about her troubled marriage, but I hadn't wanted to reveal myself. She'd trusted me with her vulnerability, but I'd kept mine hidden. Perhaps I'd taken some satisfaction in thinking that though my sister was wealthier, more formally educated, and more beautiful by far, my marriage was happier. I'd finally bested her in something. I hated to think this about myself, but I couldn't entirely deny it. Still, in the end, I'd chosen loyalty to my husband over loyalty to my sister, and that she would simply have to understand. Perhaps she did, because Angelica put her hand atop mine. My poor sweet Eliza. All husbands stray. A little dazed, I nodded as she uttered the words I'd imagined her saying all those years ago. I know how tender your heart is, and how easily wounded you are, but I don't believe I am easily wounded. That was a different sister, she remembered. I'd changed, and I wanted her to know it. So I told her the rest. Oh, to confront Monroe! She put down her shears and the basket of roses, and drew me down onto a marbled bench. I would applaud if I didn't know this will come to no good. That half-wit fancies himself to be a useful acolyte in Vice President Jefferson's destructive ambitions. Her habitual contempt for Monroe didn't surprise me, but her contempt for the Vice President caught me by surprise. I thought you counted Mr. Jefferson your friend. Semper Fidelis, Eliza. I am a Schuyler, too. I will always take my family's part over that of even the most charming friend. If Mr. Jefferson wished to stay in my good graces, then he ought not to have set his partisan lackeys against your husband. Now it's war. I laughed, a little darkly, but for once she was the one in earnest. My dear, it is war. Other women have suffered the pain of infidelity, but you're suffering the penalty of being the wife to the greatest man of his generation, and perhaps the greatest of our age. You'd never have suffered this if you hadn't married so close to the sun. But then you would have missed the pride, the pleasure, the nameless satisfactions. I knew how much my sister admired Hamilton, how the two of them shared the same interests and more traits of character than a casual observer might expect. I'd predicted she'd take his part. And I thought I might bristle when she did, but in the balance of things she was quite right. She took my hand. Let the children stay with me a while longer. You should go home to Papa, away from the heat of this city, away from the malice of society. Trust me, you don't want to be here while tongues wag in every coffee house, people tittering behind the pages of their gazettes as you pass by. As the days passed, the thought of escape became ever more tempting. Especially when Hamilton rode off to Philadelphia to chase down Monroe, all to no avail. My husband felt forced now to make a public confession, and therefore wished for me to have our baby in Albany.
It's for the better, Alexander said, as I imagine that you cannot much like the sight of me at present.
I settled beside him on a trunk he kept at the foot of the bed. You imagine wrong. After all, it seemed as if some different man had broken my heart. And in any case, that heart was 4 years mended. Alexander and I had each grown together into new people, better people. Though I would never reconcile myself to the cause of the change, I couldn't be sorry for it. We'd made of our marriage vows a more sacred thing than when we first spoke them. And this child in my womb, who would join us in only a few weeks, was the living proof of that. Though Angelica thinks it would be easier for me to explain to Papa. At the mention of my father, Alexander actually shuddered.
How glad General Schuyler will be for setting aside his reservations in giving his daughter in marriage to a man of low birth.
I wanted to reassure him that my father would forgive him, but I couldn't be sure of that. What I said instead was, "Perhaps we mustn't explain anything to Papa, or to anyone. Your accusers are not entitled to a reply." Hamilton nodded, folding his hands together.
"And yet the country deserves to know its system is not a corrupt scheme to line my pockets. Otherwise these Jacobins will dismantle it, and the American experiment will fail."
He'd convinced himself this was one more sacrifice he must make for his country. But I thought, give the mob this drop of blood, and it will only whet their appetite. Before I could say as much, he added,
"If I don't answer these charges of corruption, they'll take my name.
I cannot save my private reputation, and perhaps I don't deserve to, but at least my public honor may be preserved, which is all I have to give our children. Our children ought to always be able to hold their heads high with pride.
And they shall, I said, though I fretted at the chime of the clock that announced Philip was quite late in coming home from an outing with his friends.
Whether or not you dignify this with a response. My husband rubbed at his cheek, which was darkened by a shadow of stubble. Circles darkened his eyes, too.
I would like to believe that. But I remember what happened when my mother was accused in court of whoring, and she did not see fit to dignify it with a response.
All at once the specter of a woman long dead rose between us again. His mother had condemned her children to a life of illegitimacy by letting the accusation pass. Perhaps that is why Hamilton never, ever let anything pass. And knowing this, I would not ask him to. He caught my fingers between his and sighed.
The rest of the children can stay here with their governess, but let Philip take you to the pastures, for your and his sake. He's almost a man grown now. His friends will have heard the gossip. I do not wish for him to feel compelled to defend me, or maybe I cannot bear to face his disappointment.
Downstairs, we heard the door open and close. Then footsteps trudging up the stairs that could only belong to a troubled boy. Perhaps my husband was right. But I worry to leave you now, Alexander. Especially now. My husband took a breath, then another.
Eliza, if you stand beside me, the public will eviscerate you. With such men as those hounding me, nothing is sacred, even the peace of an unoffending and amiable wife. They will hurt you because of their fury against me.
He took my face in his hands and stroked my cheeks tenderly.
No man who loves his wife could wish this upon her. No loving father could wish his child born into such circumstances. I realize that I have forfeited my right to command you as a husband. But I command you in love to go. To take care of yourself, to keep up your spirits, and to remember always that my happiness is inseparable from yours.
Stand by him and die, renounce him and live. Once, I wondered what I would have done if I'd been caught in such a conundrum. I did not face death, of course, but the choice before me seemed strangely similar, and the answer no clearer or easier now. August, 1797, Albany. The river washed over my bare feet with a pleasant coolness, my petticoats bunched up at my knees. Seated on the dock next to Papa, who held a fishing pole in his hand and wore a broad straw hat upon his head, I squinted into the bright sun and imagined I was a girl again. Perhaps my father was imagining it too, because puffing his pipe, he put a worm onto the hook for me, as if I didn't remember how to do it. A week before, Hamilton had seen me and Philip off at the sloop, simultaneously solicitous and morose. And Angelica dashed off a note that same night to tell me that my dejected husband had gone to her house thereafter and stayed well into the night, unable to speak of anything but me. Meanwhile, we all tried to speak of anything but him. On the deck of the sloop, my 15-year-old son treated me as if I were made of glass. Philip had become a man already, I'd realized with a motherly pang. He took his quick wit and devilish smile from his father, but the rest of him was all Schuyler, tall, dark, and loyal. Having been commanded by his father to watch over me in my delicate condition, my son carried my bags, fetched lemonade, and played games of backgammon with me in our berth at night. My family was even more solicitous in Albany. Mama had everything ready for me, sweet herbs for my pains, pastries for my cravings, and the Bible from which she read to me.
Peggy came to help me birth the babe and told my son what great things were expected of him at Columbia College, where he was soon to enroll. Papa tried to distract me with talk of canal projects and the Indians. Even Prince, now a bit bent with age, said to my son in a whisper meant for me to hear,
"Master Philip, of all these Schuyler daughters I helped bring up in this house, your mama was the one who gave me the fewest white hairs."
Philip always cringed to be called master, as it did not rest easy with him that his otherwise heroic grandfather still kept a few plantation slaves in his service. And so he took the extra pillows from Prince's arms and said,
"Well, my mother wouldn't want to give you any more white hairs climbing those stairs, so let me get her settled."
On the night that my labor pains began, my father finally raised the subject. Bending to kiss me, he whispered into my hair,
"My dear, beloved child, rest easy in knowing that no one of merit believes this filth in the newspapers."
I dreaded to tell him the truth. And weeks after birthing a wondrously healthy little boy named William, I still did not know how. Finally, sitting beside Papa on the ferry dock with fishing poles, I blurted, "I've forgiven Hamilton." My father bit the clay pipe between his teeth, his lips thinning as understanding dawned that Alexander was guilty. At the prospect of my father learning the truth, my husband had shuddered. The censure of the country he believed he could withstand. My father's judgment was another matter altogether. And I began to fear it too, because for a few moments the only sounds were the rush of the water, the cry of a peregrine falcon hunting overhead.
"Elizabeth," Papa finally said, "when you were born, I was an officer in the King's army, a young soldier of 23. I knew next to nothing about little girls, less of nursing or lullabies or medicines. That was your mama's domain."
I smiled a little to think he'd ever felt ill-equipped. But my father didn't smile. Instead, he shook his head.
"I knew only that as a father it was my duty to protect you, with sword or musket or my own life if it should come to it. And this I have tried to do. When I gave you to Hamilton, I thought I had secured for you a life of security, love, and happiness. I chose a man I believed would defend you and your heart, as I have always tried to do."
His mouth tightened, ruefully.
"I did not choose your sister's husbands, but I chose Hamilton."
And he blamed himself for it. "You didn't choose him, Papa," I said quite firmly. "You only approved him. The choice was mine. A choice I make anew every day, a choice I do not regret, no matter how unpleasant our enemies intend to make it for me." My father, whose hair had gone white and wiry, whose strong arms had withered and whose health had never been good, suffered from painful gout in his legs. I knew he was suffering now, as he took off his boots, lowered his feet into the water next to mine, and stared at the churning river.
"Do you know what you're facing with that choice?"
After years in public life, I had some idea. "Yes, Papa. I'm not a child anymore."
"You are my child," he said quietly. "Always."
The sentiment set off an ache in my chest. For as a mother myself, I understood the depth of his meaning. I felt it for my own children. No matter how tall Philip grew, I would always see him in my mind's eye as the laughing little piglet with chubby legs. It took Papa a few moments, but when he looked up again, he said,
"Do you recall that when you, Angelica, and Peggy were small, toddling about in pink ribbons, I went to London for a year on business?"
"I recall something of it," I said, for at 5 years old, dolls from England seemed almost as marvelous as welcoming home the tall and fierce warrior of a red-coated father I scarcely knew.
While I was gone, my father continued, I asked my commander, Colonel Bradstreet, to watch over my family. At my request, he helped your mother build our new mansion here. And I returned home to find all of you living together here with Colonel Bradstreet, with whom your mother had formed an uncommon friendship in my absence.
An uncommon friendship? I remembered. Colonel Bradstreet was so fond of Mama that when he died, he left property to her. And all my life, I'd thought nothing of it until this excruciating moment. In shock, I whispered, Surely you're not intimating.
I am intimating nothing but that the friendship was a subject of speculation.
My father's jaw hitched, and my belly roiled at the thought that he might have known the pain of adultery. Yet everything I knew of my parents forced my mind to rebel. Mama would never. With more calmness than he perhaps felt, Papa puffed at his pipe.
There was gossip.
That I did not remember. That I'd never known. I was too young to have realized it. And I wondered if Angelica, who was older, had been more aware, and if it accounted for her sometimes troubled relationship with our mother. Surely Mama denied any impropriety. A small, bittersweet smile tugged at his lips.
I did not ask her.
Indignation positively burned in my breast. Why ever not? Papa's fingers drummed lightly upon his knee, as if he were counting.
If she were guilty, she might confess. And how should a gentleman respond? If I ran Bradstreet through with my sword, it would have gained me nothing but a momentary pang of satisfaction and a dead friend. It would not forestall the gossip of cuckoldry, nor the destruction of your mother's fine name. It would have followed you, my dear children, and made you unhappy all your lives.
As the gossip about Hamilton would now follow my children all their lives. To his litany of horrific consequences, my father added,
And if your mama was innocent, as she surely was, then to insult her with an accusation would make me the vilest of knaves. I should consider myself condemned to hell fires if I treated your mother with such rank suspicion. A woman who entrusted herself to me, risked her very life to bring my children into the world. A woman who defended my lands, served as wise steward over my household, and blessed my life with her wisdom, friendship, affection, and love. Such ingratitude would damn me in the eyes of myself and my God.
So he would not ask, I thought. He would never ask. My father, like the mathematician he was, had added it all up. The sums of love and happiness and disappointments in a marriage. And come to the conclusion that it didn't matter. Just as Maria Reynolds did not matter, regardless of what the papers said. Regardless of what anyone said.
What I decided to do,
Papa explained,
was to name my first son, born after there could be any question of his parentage, John Bradstreet Schuyler.
In defiance, I realized, my father had mustered the strength to defend his marriage with a thumb in the eye of anyone who would question it, just as I would have to do now. And he was asking me if I had the stomach for it.
In the matter of Hamilton, Papa concluded, your family's view of this unfortunate episode will be guided by your calculation, Elizabeth, and only yours.
I'd always admired his ability to swallow bitter injustices for the greater good. But how could I follow his example? Whatever I'd told myself in coming here, I knew the real reason Hamilton had sent me to my father.
Eliza, if you stand beside me, the public will eviscerate you.
Stand by him, or renounce him. Hamilton wanted me to have that choice. But I'd already made it. And taking a deep breath,
I determined to begin defending my own marriage right here in this moment.
Then forgive him, Papa, as I have done, truly.
The Bible tells us no man is without sin, no man is righteous, not even one.
My father nodded. Then not another word was said about it.
My family never behaved in word or deed with anything but devoted affection to my husband. And because of it, and because I was my father's daughter, I found within myself the strength to face the storm.
Chapter 30. Art thou a wife? See him whom thou hast chosen for the partner of this life, lolling in the lap of a harlot.
The Aurora, a Jeffersonian newspaper. August, 1797, New York City.
How could he confess in such humiliating detail?
Angelica had come to my house, clutching my husband's pamphlet with white knuckles, demanding we go out and buy up all the copies.
50 of the best pens in America could not have done more to put him in infamy.
You know why he did it, I said, not wishing to go over it even once more. Ever since I'd confronted Monroe, I'd understood with a cutting clarity that Alexander would be forced to prove the affair to clear his name of worse charges. And like a papist penitent, he'd done just that, donning a veritable hair shirt of irrefutable evidence and frank revelations, each more torturous than the next. My only regret was in refusing my husband's offer to review his confession before he'd published it. It had been the one time I'd had no interest in bearing witness to the inner workings of his mind, when I'd been too heartsick to persuade him to moderate his tone. And the result? The Reynolds pamphlet ran more than 90 pages, cataloging every possible aspect of the affair, as if he thought he could drown his opponents in words and wash himself clean.
Hamilton's pamphlet reads like one of Peggy's tawdry novels, Angelica groaned, as if she herself were the wronged wife instead of me. Why, the letters his harlot sent him, children spell better. What could he have seen in her?
His mother, I thought. It always came back to her, but I dared not say it, and I dared not fall back into the trap of dissecting the affair.
Wine, I asked instead, taking a bottle from an exquisite silver cooler.
It was unlike me to drink in the middle of the day, but I took comfort where I could, not only in the chilled wine against the August heat, but also in that the cooler was a gift from George Washington that had recently come with a note I treasured.
A token of my sincere regard and friendship. I pray you to present my best wishes, in which Mrs. Washington joins me, to Mrs. Hamilton, and that you would be persuaded with every sentiment of the highest regard, I remain your sincere friend.
If the Washingtons stood with us in solidarity, how could I waver? My sister took the proffered glass of wine and gulped it.
One word from you and Hamilton is ruined forever. I hope he knows it.
She'd been his defender at first, but since reading his confession, she'd become mine. And I suppose that I needed one when the newspaper's poisoned ink against him turned on me, too. I'd never been singled out for such public opprobrium before. Never bad to loathe the man I loved or be considered complicit in his sins. The insults from jeering Republicans didn't wound me over much. I dismissed the lot of them as a nod of conspiring, godless scoundrels. Like my husband, I was even coming to take some perverse pride in being the object of their rancor and venom. But the cruelty of our fellow Federalist friends did cut me. It was confided to me that our new president's lady, Abigail Adams, crowed to her friends that she'd always known my husband to be a lascivious debauchee, in whose wicked eyes she saw the very devil, as if I should have seen it too, and made a better choice in husband. Society ladies I'd entertained on countless occasions crossed the street to avoid brushing skirts with me, lest scandal be contagious.
for I was a wife who'd failed to inspire fidelity. And yet, my fidelity to him was now also to be counted against my virtue. I could neither leave my husband nor love him without offending somebody. As the wronged wife, there was nothing whatsoever